On the next Mind's Eye Radio, it's Wipe That Smile Off Your Face, or I'm So Impressed, where we explore the many faces of, well, faces, with impressions that rove through ancient Hebrew history, beginning in seriousness, passing through solemn silliness, and on to impressing folks at parties sporting a lampshade on one's head. It's Wipe That Smile Off Your Face, or I'm So Impressed, on the next Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio in your face. Kong Looks Back on His Tryout with the Bears by poet William Trowbridge.
If it had worked out, I'd be on a train to Green Bay, not crawling up this building with the Air Corps on my ass. And if it weren't for love, I'd drop this shrieking little bimbo 60 stories and let them take me back to the exhibit. Let them teach me to rumba and do imitations. They tried me on the offensive line. They told me to take out the right cornerback for Nagurski. Eager to please, I wadded up the whole secondary. Then I stomped the line, then the bench and the locker room, then the east end of town to the river. But they were not pleased. They said I had to learn my position, become a team player. The great Father Bear himself said that. So I tried hard to know the right numbers and how the arrows slanted toward the little O's. But the O's and the wet grass and the grunts drowned out the count, and the tight little cheers drew my arrow straight into the stands. And the wives tasted like flowers and raw fish. So I was put on waivers right after camp, and here I am, panty sniffer, about to die a clown, who once opened a hole you could drive Nebraska through.
That was Kong Looks Back on His Tryout with the Bears by poet William Trowbridge. A quick Googling of the net under impressions and impersonations yields several hundred hits, but one that catches the eye right away is a site dedicated to ordinary people who do impressions of their favorite stars, live and dead. The Elvis impersonators seemed too scary, but checking the Marilyn Monroe site was only slightly less so. Marilyn, it turns out, is much taller, smaller, blonder, darker, and thinner than one would have imagined. There were even a couple of men taking a shot at mimicking the blonde beauty. If one clicked on the little icon, one could hear the impersonator sing or speak. One didn't go there in this case, but the Mind's Eye Collective today didn't veer away from the subject, but rather pulled on the mask with glee in today's show, Wipe That Smile Off Your Face, or I'm So Impressed. Renaud Catalani discovers that even ordinarily mild-mannered persons sometimes find themselves turning nasty in his story, Imposters. All it may take, in fact, to transform them may be a particularly trying traffic jam and a talkative toy.
I don't know how it happens. Maybe you do. How your simple stuff suddenly turns difficult. How first impressions metamorph into people so complex. Ordinarily, when times turn to stink, we turn to our elders, always have. Our big uncles have seen it all, crushing colonial Europeans, brutal imperial Japanese, cruel communists. Pero listen, let me tell you what happened. What happened in my blue Toyota I-94 southbound, trying to beat Milwaukee's downtown exodus. End of another drone bee's day. I was doing no good, not in traffic nor my life. Thousands of us were inchworming bumper to bumper. News was on the radio. My son's transformer was on the passenger seat. Transformers, in case you don't know one, are little cars, big rigs, and motorbikes that'll change into ferocious Autobots and Omnicons or Decepticons. Optimus Prime was on my seat, disguised as a meaty 18-wheeler. I picked him up and turned out his massive quadriceps. I twisted round some monster biceps, rocket-powered boots thick as overpass pillars. I set him on the passenger seat, facing front. A river of stalled commuters cringed collectively as Corey Flintoff recited Tuesday's Baghdad deaths, another jeep full of soldier boys from San Diego. When I glanced at my transformer bud, he was working my tired Toyota's right side window crank. It was giving him some trouble on account of his hands being pig-iron crescent wrenches. "What the hell's with the Stone Age ventilator handles?" he muttered. Rude. It wasn't really a question. "Well, you know," I said, a little hurt, not used to nobody dissing mi coche. "Those sissy electric windows are always breaking down, and you're always taking them in," I said. $200 a fix, minimum. "Ah, that's poppy poop," he said, still digging at it, persistent. Punk or not, he was my guest in my car, so I turned high our fresh air blower. That alloy suit must get hot. Like a new red Acura in August, electric windows acting up again. Times like these, our elders say, it's best to get polite. No matter if you don't get it, in America, polite'll get you through. "I wish I could offer you some air conditioning," I piped up, courteous tones. Yeah, but your miserable bolt buckle don't got any, doggone granola head." He turned his huge shoulders, layers of stainless steel shingles, in my direction. He had no neck. He glared my way some moments more. I kept my eyes on the forest green explorer just ahead. Our traffic clog was breaking up a bit. "What's for fuel?" he fired, Mr. Optimist did. "I beg your pardon," I said, turning down NPR. "Don't be sniveling," he barked. I said, "when are we feeding the furnace?" Without a thought, I snapped a sharp-knuckled right backhand, hoping to knock the nasty out of him. It happens sometimes. To us, these tiny acts of violence, you never know when they'll bubble up. He said nothing for a long time. I turned radio news up again. I thought about transforming Optimus into a harmless semi again. When I looked over, his helmet was tilted toward me. "Is that it?" he said, menacingly calm. "Is that the best you got?" "Hey, shut up," I said, pretty unkind. "I mean, I really look forward to Silvia Poggioli from Roma, and this bot was pushing my buttons." "You know who you're talking to, junk man?" he asked. So I said, "Can it, Piston Head? Mandalit del Barco was just coming on. I love her Paraquito accent." "Among all heroes of Cybertron," he launched into his own Q&A, "I am the powerful leader of Autobots. I do a lie," went for my volume knob. "I am vowed to fight against evil Decepticons in their quest to plunder Earth of its Energon." "Look, Lucknut," I said, "you got no power, you are no leader, you make no vows, you are a man-toy, no mas." That shut him down. He stared straight ahead. His armadillo-gloved fingers thrummed my console. I cracked my window. Our jam thinned. "Look who's calling who a poser," he croaked at last. It wasn't a question, more like an indictment, really. And it iced me. Cold. He did. Only one of us in my true blue Toyota was, after all, an affirmative action alumnus. Approximating American, insinuating success, an impersonator. "All right, smart guy," I said upbeat, disguising his direct hit. "Why don't you make like a Mac and semi on down that interstate?" It wasn't a question. I scanned my mirrors, looking to scoot off the shoulder, to flip and fold and snap my mouthy metal bud back into place. But it was all becoming increasingly unlikely. He twisted his ridiculously slim waist, turning his entire torso to me. Mano a mano, eye to eye, were it not for those reflector shades. I hadn't noticed him scaling up, his monstrous deltoids now packed against our ceiling. My blue Toyota leaned painfully. "All right, brown boy," he said, barely disguising his malice. "Why don't you make like a mild-mannered minority male, keep both your soft hands on the wheel, and hum quietly on down that highway?" It wasn't a question. For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Ronald Latangsa, Jan Catalani.
Norma Gay Pruitt curses her fate in just being so darned accurate in judging character.
My first impressions generally turn out to be right. Some people can woo me, and I can be fooled for a while about whether some man or woman will be my type. But in the end, my instincts usually turn out to be correct. I still have friends that I made in childhood. Not many, I grant, but a few. They were generally people I gravitated toward immediately. Here's what I look for. A genuine, even if slow to appear, smile. Like Renee What's-Her-Name in Cold Mountain, or my Uncle Ansel, or nearly any person on my mother's side of the family. Their eyes are so softened by the frequent wrinkling of laugh lines that their eyes nearly vanish. But it's because they are pillowed in mirth. Never trust, that is, I never trust, a person whose face does not betray laugh lines. Or an intelligent solemnity. I imagine Henry David Thoreau had this gravitas. Though he imagined himself a delightful companion, he could keep his own company just fine, thank you. My husband has this. Quirkiness. An odd collection. Bird's nest, spider webs, hairballs, it doesn't matter. It means a curious mind, and I love curious people. My friend Jimmy goes out of his way to read things and subjects he doesn't really care about. His mind is open and operating, not dangerous like operating equipment. Although he likes to debate, it's in the manner of the Greeks to ferret out the truth, or at least a provisional one. As I said, sometimes I have thought I was wrong about first impressions, but it always turns out that I was not. Right at this moment, I can't think of one true friend who has turned out to finally be a stinker, a nasty soul, a cheat, a chiseler, a sociopath, who didn't send off alarm signals the first time I met him or her. As a matter of fact, I tease my students by telling them if they commit crimes later in life, I'm not going to be that English teacher the news people always seek out who says, "He was such a quiet lad, so friendly." I am going to say, "Of course he's guilty. He was just an accident waiting to happen when he first entered my classroom." Usually, when I think I may have misjudged, I just hadn't had time to give my first impression time to ripen. Here's a case study. I just got back from New Orleans, where I attended the annual Tennessee Williams Literary Festival. I had entered a one-act play into competition, but nursed few illusions that it would finally win because my play had been a sort of Hail Mary pass, actually a three-act shrunk into a one-act, which was all the judges would entertain. Therefore, in my play, everything happened at breakneck speed, and people talked fast and raced up and down the stage. I doubted I could win, since rapidity is especially anathema to the New Orleans laid-back crowd. My first impressions of my chances were once again correct. I didn't even place. But that's beside the really big point. I love this festival, which I have attended 5 times before, because it is put on by and attended by such a crazy mixture of types of people. My impression, probably not false, is that the debutantes and women's society clubs of New Orleans run the thing with iron hands and velvet gloves, exactly the kind of women Tennessee Williams lampooned in every play. But for respectability, and so that people like me can get people like my university to pay their ways, scholars and critics and rather big-time names are also invited to speak and mingle. These are the real thing many times, and very edifying to listen to. A third category is made up of tourists and folk who wander in drunk and treat the whole thing like Mardi Gras, the remnants of which still hang from trees. The beads, I mean, not the people, at least most of the time. These may include and overlap with invited guests, but it's pretty certain that their main agenda, whether they be published poets or ex-strippers, I heard some of each, is to laisser le bon temps rouler, emphasis on the rouler and mainly in the hay. I watched one old guy in particular, who actually seemed inflated with his own opinion of himself, flirt with the street urchin boys, playing the William S. Burroughs to these scornful but conniving acolytes. They were sopping up his bourbon, but I saw them ditch him as soon as he got up to read his pretentious poems. My point is, I had made this guy for the fool he was as soon as I noticed him. He worked out terribly predictably. The same went for the earnest academics in their shabby, chic, all-hemp attire. I tell you, it's an absolute curse to be so good at this first impression business. This is Norma Gay Pruitt saying, maybe, baby, I got your number for Mind's Eye Radio.
You string me along just for the thrill of it. You don't want to kill time, you want to murder it. While I'm losing sleep, you're sleeping it off. Act like it's such a great invention that you can impersonate romantic intention. Pleased with how well you carried it off. And you may be the queen of masquerade. Great charade, I can tell, now you know, blessing in disguise. Want me to be loyal and protective, you're a sultry woman, I'm your cheap detective. You'll take a powder while I'm chasing down false leads. Can't be bothered by a whirlwind of passion, never commit the crime of fashion. When you give me the slip, you dress appropriately. And you may be the queen of masquerade. You may pull off the great charade. I can tell now you know, blessing in disguise. Like to work undercover and long to be someone's secret lover. You claim you have no permanent address, and your name is just a lover's. You think everything is staged for your benefit. You like to think you have a dangerous laugh, but you're hoping disaster doesn't flirt back, and that everyone can be easily tricked. And you may be the queen of
This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
Who among us has not wondered why we got stuck with our particular moniker? Were our parents trying to impress Aunt Lily by calling us Dilly? Getting stuck with the wrong name is tough, making us feel, as does the namesake of Kathy Dodd Minor's poem, like impersonators.
She chafes at her name, her names, the one she was given and the one she chose to assume, the one that was her father's and the one that was her partner's father's, and always on the front end, Kathleen Ann. They are perfectly nice names, but 47 years in, they no longer seem to fit, no longer seem to say much about who she is, like a once-favored dress now gone out of style and refusing to lie flat upon her shoulders. So she plays about with nicknames and experiments with spellings and reworks the combinations, but these words conjure up someone else altogether, like labels stuck to the wrong can at the supermarket and misleading the innocent shopper as to the contents. Tomato paste where pork and beans were expected, crushed pineapple when he wanted artichoke hearts. If she could name herself now, for all she is and hopes to be and believes is important, she would fling convention to the four winds and be known by only this: lover of life, bringer of beauty. By another name, I'm Kathy Minor for Mind's Eye Radio.
Kurt Vonnegut wrote a story called Who Am I This Time?, in which a group of characters try to figure out their own personalities in the course of a play. Geithner Waldson muses about what would happen if people playing people, seeking people, didn't get personal.
So the title of this poem comes directly from the personals in the local Isthmus magazine. It's called Middle-Aged Spinster Looking for Someone to Annoy. If I could write the truly personal, what would I say? First of all, I'm definitely better than the last guy, that jerk. Then again, statistics show I'm surely not as good as the next. What I can promise is this: there'll be plenty of days when I don't disappoint you. I've had lots of practice. And, for the record, let's skip the damn coffee thing. That moment of spotting each other from across the cafe, when we realized the BL in the ad meant black, not blonde. The SP meant short Portuguese, not single professional. And we suddenly appear not as ourselves, but in colors, shapes, forms. Blonde, brown, red, tall, short, Rubenesque, sturdy. In shape, but as in the shape of a pear. Until we realize the true key to recognizing each other is in the eyes, washed over with the unmistakable cloud of disappointment. And the door invites us. Still, we are foolishly game, and our hands rise tentatively, like unsure students, already realizing that neither you nor I has any answer, or even an emotionally uneducated guess. So we decide to shake on our mutual despair. Your hair is thinner than I hoped, my skin craggier than what you imagined. Set a polyester blouse, impressed by my trifocals. For an hour we shift in our chairs, watch each other masticate muffins and scones, you leaving that annoying crumb on your cheek. And the next table is listening in, giggling, knowing what we're up to, because lovers don't interview each other as if a relationship is a job. Nor do they worry about where I, you've, they've been, or concern themselves with profession. So how about this? We'll be real personal and not contact any newspaper, not arrange to meet or pass by each other on some street or at a party, at some time, one carrying a bag of oranges, the other singing a ditty or dressed in pajamas, and we defiantly won't think we recognize each other, pausing for five counts, 10, 20, 30, then not agree to meet later at some unspecified place for drinks with real alcohol, where we won't dance with our hands on each other, and never, ever will we talk about anything personal. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Think of what you're losing by constantly refusing to dance with me. You'd be the idol of France with me. And yet you stand there and shake your foolish head dramatically while I wait here so ecstatically. You just look and say emphatically,
not this season. Yes, there's a reason. I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, madam, with you. My heart won't let my feet do things they should do. Yes, you know what? You lovely. So what? You still lovely. But oh, what you do to me. I'm like an ocean wave that bumps on the shore. I feel so absolutely stumped on the floor. Yes, when you dance, you jump in and you gentle, especially when you do the continental. But this feeling isn't really mental. For heaven rest us, I'm not asbestos, and that's why I won't dance. Why should I won't dance. How could I won't dance. Mercy be good. I know that music leads the way to romance. So if I hold you in my arms, I won't dance.
When most people think about poetry, they may envision hearts and flowers. But poet Oscar Morelos thinks, well, digitally.
I arrived late to the Mind's Eye Poetry Group meeting, and I interrupted a critique of a prose poem about a father tragically losing his finger in a lumberyard accident. And before I could shake the impression of a crushed finger bleeding and screaming out of my mind, another writer mentioned that her father had accidentally cut off his finger one day and saved it in a baby food jar alongside other body parts he had lost. And I did not have the nerve to ask which ones. Another poet said his uncle lost a finger too. Losing sounds so nice until you walk in another room and accidentally find it again. I thought about the time my oldest son Diego almost snipped the tip of his index finger off with the neighbor's hedge trimmer. His mom Clara put his hand inside the coffee beans of a Folgers can to stop the bleeding, because this is what her grandfather did on his coffee plantation when a worker cut themselves with a machete. After rushing to the hospital to get 7 stitches, at the end of the day, the mangled tip was still hanging on to the end of his finger. I didn't realize that poetry could be so hard on your hands. This is Oscar Morelos for Mind's Eye Radio.
Well, we've only exhausted half of our masks. Stick around as Mind's Eye writers tout their amazing powers of prestidigitation and the perils of trusting a blessing dropped in your lap. One writer even suggests a way to drop the FaceTime and still find the love of your life.
Thank you.
In the days of colder weather, the piles of snow along the curbs would get more and more gray, finally getting black streaks and spots in them. They looked so permanent that Fran Rawl was moved to comment on them.
Remnants. The grizzled piles stubbornly squat along the roads like granite erratics left here by the glaciers. Said a friend, "These March winds, you know, will soon melt away all that old snow." Maybe, I thought, but I think it's going to take a lot to shift these babies. This is Fran Rawl, mushing along for Mind's Eye Radio.
Impressing folks at parties entails more than just sporting a lampshade on one's head. As John Morgan sadly discovered, sometimes one can try a little too hard.
You know, Bill, what I miss about living in the North is the mockingbirds. You never see any mockingbirds around here.
You're right about that, Alice. But why do people call them mockingbirds? How do we know they're not just impersonating other birds?
I suppose you could be right. Mocking is probably beyond a bird brain's imagination. So we should call them impersonating birds? That sounds kind of awkward.
Well, we could just call them impersonators.
But why do they impersonate?
I don't know. Why do people do impersonations?
I don't do impersonations, do you?
Oh, a few.
Really? Who can you impersonate?
Well, I can do Tom Waits.
Oh, I gotta hear that. Can you do Tom Waits reciting T.S. Eliot?
Sure, if I can remember any. Here goes. This is Tom Waits with the opening of the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock.
Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. Let us go through certain half-deserted streets, the muttering retreats of restless nights in one-night cheap hotels and sawdust restaurants with oyster shells. Streets that follow like a tedious argument of insidious intent to lead you to an overwhelming question. Oh, do not ask, what is it? Let us go and make our visit. In the rooms, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo.
Okay, that wasn't too bad. Who else can you do?
Well, I can do T.S. Eliot. I heard him on a record once.
Okay, I want to hear you do T.S. Eliot reciting Bob Dylan.
You really want to make things tough, don't you? Okay. This is T.S. Eliot reciting, "I'll Be Your Baby Tonight." Close your eyes, close the door. You don't need to worry anymore. I'll be your baby tonight. Shut the light, shut the shade. You don't need to be afraid. I'll be your baby tonight. Well, the mockingbird's gonna sail away. We're gonna let it. The big yellow moon's gonna shine like a spoon. You won't regret it. Kick your shoes off. Have no fear. Bring that bottle over here. I'll be your baby tonight. Yes, I'll be your baby tonight.
You know, I think Eliot would have liked Bob Dylan.
Oh, sure. They would have gotten along great.
So, can you impersonate Bob Dylan?
Sure. Well, here's Bob Dylan reciting the Gettysburg Address.
7 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Notice he didn't include women and minorities, but we fixed that up later.
just caused a little trouble. Now we are engaged in a great civil war. Testing, testing, testing. You all hear me out there? Is this microphone working all right?
You know, Bill, I think you're a mockingbird. Do you do that at parties?
No, I don't get invited anymore.
Esther Cameron's impressions rove through ancient Hebrew history, beginning in seriousness, passing through solemn silliness, and ending in children's masquerade.
It would happen to be on Purim that I logged on and was made aware, through our producer's message, that the next topic for Mind's Eye Radio would be impressions or impersonations. In the Jewish calendar, Purim is the holiday when masks and costumes are donned and skits are put on that parody the sacred writings and lampoon the authorities with many a double entendre. The Purim holiday commemorates the events related in the Book of Esther, a story built around the theme of disguise. The title figure of this story, Esther, also known as Hadassah, is taken into the harem of Ahasuerus, the king of Persia, and becomes his queen. For a long time she does not tell him that she is Jewish, but when Ahasuerus's wicked adviser, Haman, plots against the Jews, she intercedes with the king to save her people. It is very much a story of diaspora and assimilation. Esther Hadassah not only conceals her Jewishness, but is also the first person on record with a Jewish and a non-Jewish name. Moreover, her non-Jewish name, Esther, sounds like the Babylonian mother goddess, Ishtar. Similarly, the name of her uncle Mordecai seems derived from the name of the Babylonian god Marduk. As Paul Dunbar of the African-American diaspora put it, "We wear the mask." But there are deeper layers of meaning, as usual in the Jewish tradition. For that matter, other traditions also understand that the mask can serve not only to conceal what is ordinarily seen, but to reveal what is ordinarily hidden. It is precisely Esther's non-Jewish name, her disguise, that reveals the deepest meaning of the Purim text. For the rabbis relate this name to a verb that means to conceal, as in the Torah passage where God says, "I shall hide my face from them." The diaspora's situation is a hiding of the divine countenance in secular history, where the people can no longer rely on direct divine intervention and are apparently at the mercy of historical forces. Thus, the name of God is not mentioned in the Book of Esther, and yet God's hand is felt behind the scenes, as when the king, at a critical moment, just happens to open the chronicle to the account of Mordecai's service to him. To a feminist, the theme of hiddenness is significant in still another way, since the name of the protagonist is that of a goddess. The people are saved by the return of a mother image that is ordinarily obscured, or at best relegated to the esoteric depths of the Kabbalah. And so this story has always given me a bit of hope. That's one reason why I chose the name Esther when converting to Judaism. That someday there could be a serious Purim, when the mere anarchy that seems to have been loosed upon the world could be held in bounds again through the revelation of some deeper aspect of human being. It can't really be true, after all, that we are condemned to go forever through this bloody farce in which the world seems to be run by the Ahasueruses and the Hamans. We have the resources to turn it around. We just have to learn how to call on them, how to bring them to light. The poet Rainer Maria Rilke once wrote, "Is it possible that despite discoveries and progress, despite culture, religion, and world wisdom, one has remained on the surface of life? Is it possible that one has even covered this surface, which might still have been something, with an incredibly uninteresting stuff which makes it look like the drawing room furniture during summer holidays? Yes, it is possible. But then it should also be possible to pull off the dust covers. And paradoxically, as I've been trying to suggest, one possible way of pulling the covers off is through impersonation. There is, after all, a school of therapy which tells people to act as if they are happy, brave, competent. Or as Hamlet says to Queen Gertrude, assume a virtue if you have it not. Maybe we just need to hold that thought, pursue it a little further. I'd like to share with you a poem I wrote after a performance by the young Shakespeare players of Madison about the power of impersonation. Children play Shakespeare on a summer's eve, their theater a house they've hollowed out. On a black painted stage they move about among black crates and pallets, props that leave much to the imagination. We receive, likewise, a maid child of 8 years for stout Fortinbras. White is brave and conquers doubt. But isn't that the way of make-believe? Less to resemble than to represent, to posit more than simulate, to say, let this be that. And in the mind's eye rises all of the splendor that the poet meant. Cynic, behold, be changed. The human play is not yet done, and still may hold surprises. See you in costume next year, or maybe sometime soon. I hight Esther, a.k.a. Beatrice, the Lady of the Sorrowful Continents, for Mind's Eye Radio.
Although today's car rental companies will accept a returning car from anyone, not just the person named in the contract, that was not always so. In Wisconsin in the early 1980s, there were severe penalties. Because of this, the character in Evie Thompson's short story has been enlisted to impersonate her client in the return of a car.
"Oh, by the way," he said, taking my hand and placing the car keys in it, "when you get to the Hertz desk, just pretend to be me and sign my name." My client Terry's tall frame was silhouetted against the plate glass windows overlooking the airfield, so I couldn't see his face. "Gotta go," he said, and sailed off down the wide hallway to board his plane. But, I said, as he disappeared. I looked down at the keys as if they were a baby cobra. Sign his name? Pretend to be him? I went out to the parking ramp and got in the car. It was red, with red plush upholstery and thick red carpeting. As soon as I turned the ignition, pulsing rock music filled the car. On the interstate, I zipped and maneuvered in and out of traffic. My own small subcompact would have labored along in the slow lane, but that was what I could afford then, working as an independent political consultant. I turned off the radio. Quiet settled in. It had been fun driving with Terry from Madison to the Red Carpet Inn near the Milwaukee airport. We'd met with a number of other representatives of large corporations and their lobbyists. A new state law was costing their companies and Terry's millions of dollars, and they wanted it changed. I felt honored to be there, the only woman at the table, and, in my early 30s, the youngest. Two of the top lobbyists were there, smoking fat cigars and strategizing like boys getting ready to play football in an open lot. As a member of this team, I was to do the grassroots organizing and, incidentally, to take notes of the meeting in my spiral notebook. At a break in the proceedings, Terry turned to me and said, "I need to fly directly back to Columbus. Would you drive the car back to the Hertz place in Madison?" When I came to the rest stop, I pulled in and took out the rental agreement left in the glove compartment so I could find out what kind of trouble I might be in. I opened it and took off my glasses so I could get my face right up close in order to read the fine print. My God. Oh, my God. Oh, my. Oh, my God! The penalties were horrifying, and in addition to everything else, I was about to forge a name. In the past, Terry had asked me to shade the truth, even to do a bit of spying. Lying and lurking 101, I'd quipped at home, and my husband laughed. But this, was it a misdemeanor or maybe even a felony? Always before, I'd had time to lay awake at night and figure out how to deal with Terry's requests without compromising myself. As I pulled back onto the freeway, I thought, "He who sups with the devil must use a long spoon." Now, where did that come from? I never knew what that meant before, but it felt vaguely comforting, and I kept repeating it over and over. At the Madison airport, I approached the Hertz desk, feeling sick to my stomach. The clerk's name tag said, "Corinne." She pushed a form toward me. "Just fill this out." When I signed Terry Halls, I thought I was going to faint. I handed the form back across the desk. Corinne picked it up and looked it over. "Please, please," I prayed silently, "please let this be over soon." But that was not to be. Corinne got all chatty. "How do you like Columbus?" "Fine," I said, realizing I knew nothing of the place. "I lived there for a while, loved it. So what do you enjoy most out there?" Was the woman trying to find out if I was a fake? Sweat trickled down the small of my back. "I've only been there 5 years, so I still don't know the place really well. Look, I'm really tired and don't feel much like talking, and I need to make an urgent phone call. Is there some way we could expedite this process? Could I make the call while you finish this up?" Corinne looked miffed, or was it suspicious? "If you like." I went to a nearby payphone and called my husband. "I'm back. Can you come and get me?" "Yeah, give me about 45 minutes. "Okay, see you out front." I pretended to make another call, talking animatedly to the dead phone until I could see that the papers were completed. I went back to the Hertz desk, thinking, now she's going to get me. But nothing happened, and I made my escape to the ladies' room. One of the fluorescent lights was out. In the semi-darkened room, I sank onto a shiny vinyl cot. Periodically, the loudspeaker would make an announcement. I thought I heard, "Terry Halls, report to the Hertz counter." But a toilet flushed, and the sound echoed so badly through the restroom that I wasn't sure. Was airport security about to arrest me? I hoped they didn't know I was in the restroom. I contemplated going and sitting in one of the stalls, but that would have been just too much. At precisely 45 minutes, I steeled myself. I hoped they wouldn't pick me off as I crossed the lobby to the door. I was almost out when a hand on my arm stopped me. I jumped and turned. It was Corinne. "I think you left this behind." She extended my spiral notebook towards me. I took it. At the top on the front cover was my name, clearly written in the same hand I'd signed Terry's name. Had the woman seen that? Quickly, I scanned her face, but Corinne's expression was totally neutral. "Have a nice day, Miss Halls." "Thanks. Thanks a lot." Feeling shaky, I stepped outside into the sunlight. Was it time to change my line of work, I wondered? Well, no, at least not yet. I opened the car door and got in. My husband said, "How was your trip?" "Okay." "It was okay." This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Paul Thompson passes on some sage advice to his niece on her first job interview.
Dear Shauna, congratulations on graduation from Bunnington. Your parents must be very proud of you and your major in slab pottery with a minor in expressionist cinema. I'm flattered you asked me to give you advice on entering the world of work. Remember, first impressions are very important in winning that great job, that great husband, and that great car mechanic. I know that you're very proud of your individuality and your own style of doing things. I'm afraid, however, that in business it is customary to wear clothing. What to wear? I suggest a tasteful, sensible skirt and shoes to match. What you wear on top really depends on the gender of the interviewer. If you're not sure and the interviewer turns out to be male, you can always arrange a Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction at the appropriate moment. Your insistence on standing on one leg also presents a problem. Yes, your spiritual guide has said this is your path to enlightenment, but a stabler stance is needed in many occupations, along with the ability to sit at a desk, so I urge you to consider leaving your religious practices at home. I realize you can't do much about your dripping nose. You might consider blowing your nose frequently, each time yelling, "Honk if you love Bush." That will reassure your potential employers that you are mainstream American. A word about your voice. I hesitate to say this, but it sounds like the scream of a dying rabbit. Try saying, "The Frito in Tolito looks neato in Espito," several times each day, until you achieve an elegant and musical accent. If that doesn't work, look in the Help Wanted ads for a job as a steam whistle. Your fixed, maniacal grin, however, is a sure winner. Bosses like cheerful workers, and the six rhinestones embedded in your lips add a certain je ne sais quoi. The important thing is to get your foot, or feet if you take my advice, on the first rung of the career ladder. Don't be afraid to take a so-called entry-level job. Many a mailroom worker has wound up sweeping out the executive suite. The key is to tackle every task with enthusiasm, neaten up your workplace every night before you go home, and keep your eyes open for opportunity, such as reporting your boss to the IRS. They split the take, you know. Good luck in your job search. With affection, Uncle Paul.
Well, you have to ask yourself, why did that group of wild-eyed painters with light call themselves the Impressionists instead of the Certaintyists or the Foresureists? They loved to make a reality out of tiny specks of paint and were roundly decried by the Academy painters of the time. That's our show. You've been listening to Wipe That Smile Off Your Face or I'm So Impressed. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski. Original music by Barbara Chusett. Our Mind's Eye Impressionists today included Esther Cameron, Renaud Catalani, Kathy Miner, Oscar Morellis, John Morgan, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rall, Lynn Patrick Smith, Paul Thompson, Evie Thompson, and Guy Thervaldsen. If you'd like more information about our show, go to our website at www.mindseyeaudio.com. I'm your host, Greg Willard, leaving you with this quote from George Orwell. By the time you're 40, you have the face that you deserve. Best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio and good luck with your mug.